So there's some technical questions here on energy and where to put attention. I think basically you have to just, if you have a like you, the methodologies we all discover are just really to be at peace with the way things are, and craving is not being at peace with the way things are. So the abandonment of craving through that Four Noble Truths formulation is the sort of I think underlying understanding and intention. So if you understand that, and you're trying like meditation at the nose, at the heart, and you get some confusion about that, then basically you just have to give it a go. Just take an intuition, say, all right, what if I just do this or that, and see how it works. And if you're always inclining towards a sense of peacefulness, non-conflict, non-becoming, if you keep that as a kind of a momentum or a direction in the way you're putting forth effort, then intuitively you see, no, that's not going right. You won't really, I don't think you have to analyze it. You just see, and then the analysis often comes afterwards, you make some intellectual conclusion. But if you are like body conscious, and you're aware of those basic elements of becoming and resisting, and then you just try stuff, don't you? You just try stuff out, and then you find that like, that maybe the intention to, like one person found the intention to notice the beginning of a thought was too vigorous, made them hypervigilant. Another person found it helpful. So, but even if you like do something, it's hypervigilant, you still learn about something. So in Thai they say pitpen kru, mistake is teacher. So if you just keep using that kind of experimenting aspect of your psyche, and you keep in mind what we're doing. It's learning how to be with life as it presents itself and not suffer in very simple ways. And that's the last analysis. Does this teaching, do these exercises, do these times we spend together, do they fit your life? Right? Are they conducive to more meaningful life? Do they make your relationships more compassionate? Are you a better person? Just good old fashioned humanism, I suppose. That's the bottom line. But if you don't understand the project, and the project is the abandonment of craving, which is always indicative of suffering on a spiritual basis, but on a worldly basis, I want to create a monastery where there's a good training for monks. I want to create a monastery where there's good facility for lay people, right? So that's a wholesome intention. And within it, there are some aspects of my psyche which are egotistical, and some are renunciate and compassionate. So those egotistical parts that I learn about and try to let go, and the compassionate and renunciant parts I try to manifest and make them stronger. Quite ordinary, isn't it? So that's why I just keep encouraging you to everyone here has, you're really accomplished people. I hear about what work some people do. Gee, I couldn't do that. Glad I'm a monk. just encourage yourself in using that reflective capacity. That's the real secret. People sometimes ask me, what is contemplation? It's not just thinking. It's observing cause and effect, I think. And then seeing what is about this teaching that helps me in the causal nature of my conscious experience that will help me understand, help me be free, help me be a better person. One of the questions here is, when we were doing the recitation on consciousness, the five six types of consciousness are anicca, dukkha, anatta. And consciousness is used in two ways. One is there's a sense consciousness, so consciousness of sights, sounds, smells, tastes, bodily feelings, and mental formations, and combinations of those. But there's another kind of consciousness which is anidasana, I think it's called anidasana, vijnana, which is unmanifest consciousness. And that's pointing to something that is transcendent, and that would be really what awareness is pointing to. Because awareness is not sound, and it's not taste, you know, it's something that knows those things. And that's the great mystery of life, isn't it? That not only can I be happy and unhappy, I can notice that I'm happy and unhappy. This is the kind of great. And usually the unspiritual mind is just caught up with the happiness and the unhappiness, whereas the spiritual mind, I think, is a much more, it's kind of interested in that movement. Excellent here. How can we be comfortable with the first precept when we eat meat? You salt? I don't know. that's one of the first precept is about not killing. So it's about the intention to kill. So if one chooses to be a vegetarian, what you're practicing is renunciation. Like if you like meat, say if you don't like meat, it's nothing. But if you like meat and you decide not to eat meat, or you start to be a vegan or whatever, then you're practicing renunciation. Because it's about what the mind does. It's not about the economics of eating meat. But if you read someone like Peter Singer, you know, the great ethicist, he's really strongly vegetarian. He says, how can you Buddhists eat meat? Because you're supporting the meat industry. But the way the precepts are set up is really, it's not about economics. Economics would be about the way I live in the world in terms of my decisions that I can make with the things that I buy and the things that I eat and so on. So in terms of the precepts are really about how what kind of intentions your mind takes you to, and they have social consequences. So not killing takes a strong intention to kill something, but it takes a much stronger intention to kill a human being than a mosquito. It takes much more effort, much more energy, much more stupidity. It takes a different kind of effort to shoot a deer than to step on a cockroach in your bedroom or something like that. So intentionality is not just like monochrome. It has intensity in it, doesn't it? It has a volume in it. So if I like something and I decide for ethical, compassionate reasons, no, I'm gonna give that up. That's also an intention. Right? It's an intention in my mind, and then I said, no, I won't have meat. So when the meat's there. But if I eat meat, my intention isn't, like eating venison is different than shooting a deer. it's a different kind of mental experience, isn't it? So what happened in Theravada Buddhism is that there was a fellow called a cousin, second cousin of the Buddha, who was very powerful, but he was a monk, he's very deluded, and he wanted to take over the monastic order. His name was Devadatta. And so he had his own following, and he thought, well, okay, how can I gain more influence than the Buddha? And he thought, well, people praise asceticism. And if I'm more ascetic than Gotama Buddha, then more people will come to me. So he then went to the Sangha and said, made five demands. One of them being that monks should not eat meat. The others being kind of ascetic practices, which were kind of tending towards the way the Jains lived. And the Buddha rejected those. He says, no, you're alms mendicants, monks are alms mendicants, and they accept with gratitude what is offered. And Devadatta did get some more followers, but you know, soon saw that he was rather deluded, and so his following fell away. So he's the sort of bad guy. Bad guy in Buddhism. Of course, he doesn't fare well. Bad guys don't do well in religion. But it's an interesting, like, asceticism is much praised. You get a monk who's very, very ascetic and renunciant, he'll get a lot of praise, but he might be totally repressed. You don't know. Take it from me. So you can have someone who's very, very willful and seems very, very ascetic, but they can be quite unhappy too. Not that happiness is the litmus test of enlightenment. But, so for the monastic order, we accept what's offered. And I've tried to run monasteries where we just do vegetarian food. And I just found that, like, people who weren't vegetarians would bring their food, and then someone in the community, you can't bring that chicken. Like they were sinful for bringing meat. But that was their cultural norm, was to, for them to offer monks meat, was you offer them the very best food, and that was their vision of what the best food was. Allow people. So I went through that, and I thought, well, no, that's, you know, I just have to let it take its course, and whatever it take its course. But in the Mahayana Buddhism, say in the Vietnamese, so we go to Tuan Pagoda in Ottawa, they're vegetarian. So quite often, they think that Theravadins are totally barbaric. and so there, you know, you get this kind of different histories and different cultural viewpoints that kind of come up in Buddhism. And there was an incident in one of our monasteries outside North America where one of the lay people was a very ardent vegetarian, and another group weren't. And this group brought food the night before for the monks, and the vegetarian was actually helping also in the next morning, and this person hid the food, didn't give it to the monks, right? So, which was, you know, imagine the people that offered the food, they got really confused by that. So this is a kind of complex issue that comes up in Theravada Buddhism. So I would just say that try to contemplate that, what intentionality is. And obviously, if you kill something, that is a certain kind of mindset. And when you practice renunciation, that's a certain kind of mindset. And when you enjoy meat, that's a certain kind of mindset. It's about the mind. So then, lay people are, you make choices. You make whatever choices you want to make around that. And then, lay people will have their own discussions around that. What's appropriate, and that's good. Those are good ethical discussions. But for monastics, we're sort of our principle is like to be grateful for what's offered. Okay. So in terms of lifestyles and all that, I'm sure you got it all sorted out. I don't want to tell you how to live your life. You know. But if you have a chance to come and visit the monastery, you're always welcome. And but I would suggest, like, try to keep a sitting practice going, because the mind needs space to reflect, to empty out, to come to silence, to come to stillness. So that's a discipline that's quite hard, I've heard, for lay people. I don't know. But if you can keep up a really good daily life practice, now you got a bit of momentum, right? You're kind of rolling along. So set your clock and use, if you like, imagery. Or just think about when you came into the room and you saw me sitting here, what did that do to your mind? It stops the mind, doesn't it? That's the way you want to use a Buddha Rupa. You get some imagery that when you come into a space, oh yeah, that's what it's about. And you're going to, you need to settle your mind. That's what iconography can be used for. So there's a lot of spiritual ways of expression which are outside of Theravada. So I would prefer the morning chanting to be something like Handel's Messiah than what we do. But it's not an option I have. So it's a small vehicle. We don't do Handel's Messiah. But you as lay practitioners, you have more options. So you can use creative things and visual things and audio things. But you want to go beyond just getting inspired. Because there's something about uplifting the mind. So if you listen, if you like that kind of Handel's Messiah, that kind of thing, it'd be really, ooh, it's just really neat. But then if you always need to be uplifted, then the danger there is then you are always preoccupied with attributes. And that preoccupation in itself prevents that availability, which takes you to that which is beyond attributes. So it's how do you use those beautiful things in your life to take you to a sense of stillness rather than to a sense of need? And this is the difference between like idolatry and symbology, because idolatry is like praising the self, the thing itself. Like if I listen to music and then I need to listen to more music and more music, then I'm enthralled by the object, which is idolatry. There's me and there's the object, like the Buddha Rupa. But if I use sound or visual things as a way of bringing me to silence, so now that forest does that, doesn't it? You go into those big pines, and it's a cathedral, right? For me it is. I was just like, I was walking on the far edge of the maples, way over there where that old age home is, I think. And then kind of came through the maples, and then, wow, it's lovely. Now, I know I can't transplant those to Tisserna. So there's no, there are no old growth forests left in Ontario, which is shocking when you think about it. And well, I can't own this, so it's a symbol. It's a symbol, or it's pointing to the silence in my own mind. That's the beauty of natural forms. And so, music can be used that way, or literature. But like literature, like you could. I'm sure there's. I don't watch YouTube and those kinds of things. I'm sure you could do YouTube Dharma things day in and day out, right? I'm sure. But that could be a kind of entertainment, I suppose. We just always need something to entertain you, which is fine. But entertainment never hurt anybody. But sometimes the challenge of like just the daily practice, where you're just in the doldrums, ho hum. God, another half an hour of meditation. You have to bring up energy. You have to bring up energy and make it happen without some kind of external thing. And this is very much monasticism, is that it's like same old, poly chanting, right? Bad voice leader. Or, sometimes a good voice, we switch around. And then you begin to say, oh, how can I be mindful with this situation rather than always need inspiration? Because inspiration is obviously it's a nice bit of energy, but inspiration itself is still an attribute. It's still a type of mindset, which if I use it well, it's good. But if I don't understand it, then inspiration is dualistic. And that desperation, or what's the opposite of inspiration? Of disappointment or something like that, or lowness or whatever. That also is just a part of life. Just a part of life, and there's nothing wrong with it. And oftentimes those bits which aren't inspiring, which are just ho-hum, and you just bear witness to them, leads to actually a peacefulness, because that's where the craving arises lots of times. Inspiration craving doesn't arise because you're already eating the ice cream. Right? What kind of ice cream is a heart, as it were? So you're sort of uplifted that way. But then when it falls away and you don't have the uplift, what we seek compensations and externalities and attributes and things like that to get that lift again. But that's that very going outwards into the formed world from tanha, from restlessness, from need that we're trying to witness and say, even that I can witness too. And it's in its cessation you reach a deeper peace because it's now no longer dependent on inspiration, on attributes. And that's, you know, we've all seen that challenge, I think. And that comes up a lot in your meditative life. It comes up a lot. So without denying the beauty of inspiration or the beauty of art and the usefulness of it, you know, because that's sometimes, Theravada Buddhism can sound terribly wet blanket philosophy. It's just that chant, I'm of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond age. I'm of the... Can you think of a more depressing chant? But it only makes sense. It only makes sense if you're aspiring to the transcendent. Then it's a warning. If you don't understand it, gee, give me some Bob Dylan, will you? But if you're looking at, well, why is he saying that? He says, you know, you've got work to do. You're not beyond aging. And the transcendent is beyond aging. So then it makes sense. That makes sense, but in and of itself, because I was just chanting that this morning, like, you've got to give them something to uplift them, I guess. So I'd sing that, I get him to do Boris Godunov for us, some deep Russian chanting or something.
Sure.
Yeah, I really enjoy his kind of deep Russian voice. So, art has its place. And beauty is very important, I think. It all has its place. But the opposite has its place too, doesn't it? The peaceful coexistence with a rainy day as well as a sunny day. Again, it's a bit of a cliche, but it's very, very true. And when the heart finds that place of peaceful coexistence with all dualities, then there's a kind of stillness in not needing anything. And I think more and more what comes from that is the gratitude to beauty, the gratitude of goodness, the gratitude of things every now and then coming together. Right? And then the patience with it all falling apart. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way it is. Isn't it? It's a lot, as you know, like the phrase that Lompo Sumedho always offers me when we're having a good time together. We're doing a Starbucks in Seattle and having two, what are they called? Not frangipani. Frappuccinos. Frangipanis. We're having these two frappuccinos and, you know, just lovely people and a good Dharma discussion. And he says, Viradhamma, this is a peak moment. and it's like, yeah, I'm going to enjoy this with you. Yeah, and then I had jet lag after that or something like that. Something changed. So you don't, Theravada, it sort of emphasizes the letting go, and it doesn't emphasize attributes so much of, it does through samadhi practices and the brahmaviharas. But why, you know, it's pointing to the transcendent. That's why sometimes you get these seemingly dry statements. That's what it's pointing to.